From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Eric Bana describes his character as a jerk in Judd Apatow's new movie, Funny People. Although Bana portrays one of the few characters in Funny People who is not a comic, he actually was a famous comic in Australia before starting his film career. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Bana. His movies include Chopper, Black Hawk Down, Munich, and The Hulk. The man who trained the dolphins that played Flipper in the 1960s TV series, Rick O'Barry, is now an activist who opposes the slaughter of dolphins. The new documentary, The Cove, follows him to a village in Japan where thousands of dolphins are slaughtered. David Edelstein will review the film, then we'll talk with O'Barry and the director of The Cove, Luis Sahoyas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After seeing the Australian actor Eric Bana's riveting performance as a brutal criminal in the film Chopper, I was astonished to learn that he was famous in his country as a comic. He did sketch comedy and had his own TV series in Australia. Bana went on to co-star in Ridley Scott's Black Hawk Down. He starred in Steven Spielberg's film Munich and in Ang Lee's The Hulk, and he played the villain Nero in J.J. Abrams' Star Trek. Bana stars in the film adaptation of the novel, The Time Traveler's Wife, which opens next month. And starting this Friday, you can see him in the new film, Funny People. It stars Adam Sandler as George, a comic who has been diagnosed with a rare blood disease that is usually terminal. As he reflects on his life, he realizes that he still loves the woman he was in love with when he was young. But now, she's married, with two children. Eric Bana plays Clark, her overbearing, philandering husband. During one of Clark's many business trips to China, George and his assistant, played by Seth Rogen, pay a visit to the old girlfriend, played by Leslie Mann. But Clark has cut his business trip short and surprises everyone by returning early, which leads to a very awkward pizza dinner with the whole family. Seth Rogen speaks first.
This is really good pizza. You know, they say, like, New York has the best pizza, and I always thought pizza in L.A. was only okay, but who would have thought, you know, Marin County is where they really hide in the good pizza pies. Baizan.
Clark speaks fluent Chinese.
Really? You speak Cantonese or Mandarin?
Oh, well played, Ira. Mandarin.
Well gayed, Ira.
It's a bloody odd language, though, George. Jeez.
Ni hao ma.
Sounds like a scene from Deer Hunter.
Eric Bana, welcome to Fresh Air. What are some of the things that make your character likable and unlikable?
There's quite a lot to make him unlikable. I think he's quite misogynistic. He's almost a tiny bit racist as well. And he's one of those people that just sucks the energy out of the room. He's someone that you may kind of laugh at, but at the same time be a little bit repulsed by, and but can't help but love his honesty.
Now, it's interesting, the cast of Funny People is something of the Judd Apatow repertory company. Seth Rogen has worked with him a lot. Jonah Hill, who's worked with Seth Rogen a lot. Adam Sandler was Judd Apatow's roommate when they were starting out. So your character is kind of like the outsider in the movie. And in a way, you are the outsider on the set because, like, you're not part of that whole group that's made a lot of movies together.
That's right. Yeah, no, I was definitely the odd man out in the film, which you know, to me was a lot of fun. I'm a huge fan of everyone involved in the film, and particularly of Judd's work as a director. So when I got the call to be involved potentially, it was, you know, a very, very exciting thing for me because my background in Australia for many, many years before I started in movies was stand-up comedy and sketch comedy. So I was initially just really excited about the subject matter, you know, and the idea that he was delving into the working life of a stand-up comedian and a struggling, you know, starting out stand-up comedian. And Judd had done some homework on me and found some old comedy material that I'd done and was like, well, why have you not done this overseas? Why have you not done a comedy? And I said to him, I said, well, I've just never found anything remotely relevant to what I used to do. And I mean, no, I don't have that urge in me to prove a kind of funny side. It just doesn't bother me at all. And he said, well, I think this character would be great. Have a read. And I read it and just loved it immediately.
In addition to being in Funny People, you're also in a new movie that opens a little later in the summer called The Time Traveler's Wife. And give us a sense of the story of that.
Yeah, well, it's based on a great, very popular novel of the same name. And it's basically about a married couple. The husband suffers from a disease which means he involuntarily travels through time. And interestingly enough, when he travels through time, he always visits his wife as she's growing as a person. So, you know, it starts out he visits her when she's about 6 years old and then progressively visits her at various stages of her life right through until adulthood. And it poses a lot of really interesting themes and questions, and was quite beloved by a lot of women in particular.
I first saw you in the Australian independent film Chopper, in which you play a real character who is an Australian criminal. And I'd like, since most Americans aren't familiar with him, I'd like you to describe the character that you play, the real person who you portrayed.
Yeah, it's based on a real person by the name of Mark Brandon Reed, who was quite a well-known criminal, a very violent criminal in Australia. And he was most famous for the fact that he had severed his own ears off himself in order to get released from a particular wing of the prison. And he was a standover man, basically someone who stood over drug dealers for cash and for money and preyed on them in order to make a living. But he had a very, very violent past, an unbelievably, tragically violent life. And in the end, he was released from prison. The film was very controversial because he was a free person at the time that we made the film. And he's an unbelievably gregarious and funny person, and had written books whilst in prison on his life that became bestsellers in Australia, and we then made a film about a portion of his life.
I want to play a clip from the film. This is from toward the end of the movie, and you know, he's become a celebrity by writing this memoir while in prison. And so in this scene, a camera crew and a TV interviewer have come to interview him in prison.
So how would you describe yourself now?
Just a bloke. Just a good bloke down on his luck.
Well, you don't seem out of luck to me. You've written a bestseller.
Yeah, I know. And I can't even bloody spell. What about those poor bloody academics, those college graduates battling their guts out to write some airy fairy piece of exaggerated artwork, and there's a bloke sitting in a cell who can't spell and he's written a bestseller. It sold 250,000 copies and it's still selling, and he's writing another one, and I can't even spell. I'm semi bloody illiterate. They must hate my guts, hey?
I think you get a little sense in there about how this character is like, as you said, really gregarious. He's kind of charming in his own way when he wants to be, and he's really sick. And you met with Chopper. You met with this guy for like 2 days at his home. And
I did, yeah. At the time he was released from prison, was living in his home state of Tasmania. So Andrew Dominic, the director, and I went down to hang out and spend some time with him, which was, it was so valuable for me to just be in his presence. It was quite incredible, and definitely really helped me with the portrayal, for sure.
He recommended you for the part because he'd seen you in sketch comedy. And do you know why he recommended you? And did it make you wonder, what kind of vibe are you giving off that you don't even know about, that this absolutely crazy criminal thinks, yeah, he's the guy to play me?
It's a good question. He saw me when he was in jail working on a sketch comedy program that I was working on at the time called Full Frontal back in Australia. And, you know, I used to play a pretty wide range of characters, some of whom were pretty crazy. And he apparently one night was watching the show and said, I reckon he'd make a good Chopper, and recommended me to one of the producers and, in fact, the casting agent. And luckily for me, Andrew, our director, had not seen any of my work, so had no kind of preconceived notion as to what I could or couldn't do, and just screen tested me. And that's how I got the part.
My guest is Eric Bana. He co-stars in Funny People, which opens Friday, and he stars in The Time Traveler's Wife, which opens next month. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Bana, and he has two movies coming out this summer. Funny People, the new Judd Apatow movie, which opens very soon, and then The Time Traveler's Wife, which opens in August. One of the films that you're known for in America is Munich, which is Steven Spielberg's movie in which you play a Mossad agent on a team assigned to assassinate the leaders of the attack that killed 11 Israeli athletes in the 1972 Munich Olympics. Let's hear a scene from Munich. And during this mission in which you're assassinating people who Israeli intelligence suspects are the leaders of the attack that killed the Israeli athletes at the Olympics, you're starting to have doubts about whether the men you're killing really are the people responsible for the attacks, and if by killing these people you're really accomplishing something, or whether you're maybe doing something that's morally wrong. And your doubts just keep increasing. You end up moving your wife and infant son to Brooklyn for their protection, and also so that you could safely visit them, because you feel like everybody's after you now. And in Brooklyn, one of your bosses from the Mossad shows up and meets you on a bridge, and you have a conversation. He speaks first.
You did well, but you're unhappy.
I killed 7 men.
Not Salame. We'll get him, of course. You think you were the only team? It's a big operation. You were only a part. Does that assuage your guilt?
Did we accomplish anything at all? Every man we kill has been replaced by worse.
Why cut my fingernails? They'll grow back.
Did we kill to replace the terrorist leadership or the Palestinian leadership? You tell me what we've done.
You killed them for the sake of a country you now choose to abandon. The country your mother and father built, that you were born into. You killed them for Munich, for the future, for peace.
There's no peace at the end of this, no matter what you believe. You know this is true.
Here's what I know. Your father is sick, your mother will be alone. You're a Sabra, your wife and daughter are Sabras. What I came to say is this. Come home.
Come to my house for dinner tonight. Come on, you're a Jew, you're a stranger. It's written someplace or other that I'm meant to ask you to come and break bread with me. So? Break bread with me, Ephraim.
No.
It's my guest Eric Bana in a scene from Munich. Now, you're Australian, but you know you often do movies as people from other countries, and you have to use accents, like an Israeli accent in Munich, an American accent in some of your American films. I guess, was it hard to get the Israeli accent?
It wasn't. It wasn't. At first, I was like, how the hell am I going to do this? Then the more I studied it, and I have a wonderful coach that I work with, Susan Hegarty, who is great at research and had sent me a lot of materials. And fortunately for me, when the film was in pre-production, it got pushed. And we sort of went 12 months later. And so kind of like with Chopper, a similar thing happened. You just end up with about a year's more prep than you thought you were going to get. So you just use that time. So I sat with the Israeli accent for a very, very long time. It wasn't like an accelerated preparation. I probably in the end had a good 18 months to at least to get up to speed with it. And you know, my parents are of European background. My father is Croatian, my mother's German, and it's not completely similar to them in sounds, but I think having an ear for European sounds, I think, definitely helps.
You know, Americans don't think of themselves as having an accent. We think of ourselves as being like the default setting, and you know, British people have accents, Australian people have accents, but we don't. You know, so when you hear like American speech, what do you consider some of the defining characteristics?
See, I think you speak very well. I mean, I think there's two kinds of American speakers as well as there's two kinds of Australian speakers. I mean, Australians can speak very lazily, you know, and just kind of, you know, not really articulate things and have a very lazy mouth. And Americans can do the same thing where they, like, talk through their nose and, like, sort of, like, whine a little bit and all that kind of thing. But then there's that very articulate version, you know, the opposite version of both, which is very sort of succinct and clipped. And so I guess you're sort of always paying attention to those things. It does get easier over time. Obviously, I find it a lot easier now doing an American accent than I did 10 years ago. It's you sort of get more and more practice in each film when you're sitting down with your coach. You've got, you know, a different level of reference points and stuff to go on.
How did you develop your ear for mimicry and for accents and dialects?
I'm not sure that I was overly conscious of developing it. It was something that was there when I was a child. I remember impersonating my grandparents as a kid and making my grandfather laugh and thinking, oh, wow, that's really cool. And then Sundays when our family would get together, I would then, you know, stalk down the hallway with his walking stick and come in and do this weird breathing that he used to do and say a couple of words, and everyone would just, you know, just be in hysterics. And I was thinking, well, this is a pretty good way to get popular. This is pretty easy, and I could probably get out of a fair bit of trouble with this. And then I literally did the same thing at school. I used to impersonate teachers and students and would have teachers pull me aside in the corridor and say, you know, I hear you do, Mr. Walker, would you mind giving me a sample? And I would do that teacher, and then the other teacher would grab another teacher and say, have you seen Eric do Mr. So-and-so? And go on, do it. So there was a currency, you know, there was a currency in it. And I guess I sort of, there was some sort of comfort level in being able to do it, perhaps.
How did you start doing comedy?
I think out of desperation, curiosity, necessity, arrogance. It was the early 90s back in Australia, and there was a recession, and I was fresh out of school with no desire whatsoever to go on to a college seek tertiary education. I wanted to go and work on cars, and I really wanted to be an actor, and I had absolutely no idea how to go about it. And someone said I should try stand-up, and I thought it was a ridiculous idea because I wasn't the sort of person that, you know, felt a compulsion to make strangers laugh at all. But I did enjoy telling a story, and, you know, was a huge admirer of Richard Pryor as a kid, and really idolized him. So someone took me to a stand-up comedy venue, and I just assumed that everyone would be as good as Richard Pryor, right? So I went along, and one of the performers was pretty good, and the other three or four were absolutely dreadful. And my friend turned to me and said, see, it's not what you think. And I was like, well, are these people actually getting paid? So I went away, and a week later came back with 5 minutes of material and jumped up on stage and had a really good first gig. And I just started booking tryout spots around Melbourne, and it was a very, very vibrant stand-up comedy scene at the time. And it just kind of snowballed and just kept going and going. And then I reached that moment where you have to really decide if that's what you want to do, when I threw in my day job and my part-time job and decided to have a crack. And spent my time writing material and developing my act, and did that for about 10 years before I started acting.
So it sounds like you were never, you know, trained as an actor. You never went to acting school or studied acting. Is that right?
That's true, yes.
So what's it like for you when you're on the set with actors who have studied acting and they have more of a technique that they're using, and you're what you're doing is more, it sounds instinctive. Do you find that you ever clash because you're doing what you do and they're employing like a technique that they've learned?
It's interesting. I was always very fascinated when I first started acting because the differences were probably greater then. because I would arrive onto a set or onto rehearsal and see copious amounts of notes in people's scripts. And it used to freak me out as someone who was always bad at doing his homework and preparing for exams. And so I would then observe that method and find that quite often those notes were kind of crippling people and not enabling them to give up on an idea or a thought or try something new. And I always found that the minute I made a note on my script that I was signing off on an idea, and it used to scare the hell out of me. So I never made notes on my scripts. And still today I make very few. When I finish a film and I have my shooting script and I look through it, there's very, very, very little written in my script. So I guess that's probably the biggest difference that I noticed initially and probably now.
Well, Eric Bana, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. It was a pleasure.
Eric Bana co-stars in Funny People, which opens Friday, and he stars in The Time Traveler's Wife, which opens next month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from doctors and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, presenting an in-depth look at the digital generation at edutopia.org. And from Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kauffman.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The new documentary, The Cove, is about the secret slaughter of thousands of dolphins in a secluded lagoon in Japan. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews The Cove. Then we talk with the filmmaker, Luis Ojoyes, and with activist Rick O'Barry, who trained the dolphins that starred in the 60s TV show Flipper and now tries to protect dolphins from capture or slaughter. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
They call him Flipper, Flipper, faster than lightning. No one you see is smarter than he.
Rick O'Barry, the man who captured and trained the dolphins that played Flipper in the 1960s TV series, now feels partially responsible for a trend he's come to oppose, the capture of dolphins to be trained for aquariums around the world. But most of all, he opposes the slaughter of dolphins, and that's why he went to a cove in the Japanese village Taiji to document the slaughter of thousands of dolphins. The new documentary, The Cove, follows O'Barry to Taiji. We'll talk with O'Barry and the filmmaker, Luis Ojoyes, in a few minutes. First, our film critic David Edelstein has a review of The Cove.
You measure an activist documentary in two ways. First, whether it evokes a world, whether it brings the issues to burning life, instead of giving you just talking heads. Second, whether it whips you up to join the fight, or at least send a righteous email. Director Luis Sohoyas's The Cove is gangbusters propaganda on both counts. The setting, off Taiji on the rural coast of Japan, is near mythic in its beauty and mystery, and the act under scrutiny has a mythic horror. The film's second half is built like a caper picture, a white-knuckle mission by a team of idealists. They attempt to outwit a pack of greedy and vaguely demonic killers with spies everywhere. Hollywood could hardly have contrived a more dynamic scenario. The protagonist of The Cove is a man who has sinned in his own eyes and has spent much of his life trying to atone. He's Rick O'Barry, in the early 60s, the world's most famous dolphin trainer. He captured the five dolphins that became TV's Flipper, that frisky, laughing, clapping, backward-dancing Rin Tin Tin of the Florida Keys. O'Barry looks a lot like the late Richard Widmark, lean and haunted. Now he's devoted his life to liberating dolphins. When he speaks about the impact of captivity on the mammals, he doesn't sound like a showboater. And what might seem like New Agey talk about dolphin intelligence is pointed up with footage that left me haunted, too. That smile, says O'Barry, is nature's greatest deception. Dolphins smile even when they're crying on the inside. It's a billion-dollar industry, capturing dolphins for seaquariums, and its center is Taiji. But it's the dolphins who don't look like Flipper and won't attract top dollar that suffer the far more gruesome fate. The Japanese representative to the International Whaling Commission and sundry lackeys deny that any large-scale cruelty occurs, and minus pictures of actual butchery, who can prove them wrong? O'Barry and his allies need footage, what they call a game changer. Here, he talks about the place itself, the secluded, unreachable cove.
That's a dolphin's worst nightmare, right there. Hundreds of thousands of dolphins have died there. You'll see the signs, keep out, danger. There are fishermen walking around these hills with knives. This is a national park. The fishermen told me, they said, if the world finds out what goes on here, we'll be shut down. Can you imagine that? They actually told us that. We need to get in there and film exactly what happens. We need to know the truth.
The assembly of his team, divers, technicians, getaway drivers, is stirring stuff. When brilliant technicians at George Lucas's Industrial Light and Magic build fake rocks to hold video cameras, you'll forgive them anything, even Star Wars's Jar Jar Binks. Diver Mandy Ray Cruikshank models her underwater breathing techniques. She'll plant the cameras. And she has a personal stake. Weeks before the mission, we see her watch a bleeding dolphin that somehow escaped the cove as it fights the tide and slowly expires in the waves. And as she weeps, Taiji fishermen point at her and laugh. The movie reminds us repeatedly that the vast majority of the Japanese public has no idea what's going on, but it does suggest the Japanese government bribes smaller nations to join it in the fight against whaling restrictions, as if it's the prerogative of a great empire. The killing, when finally seen, is indescribable, the water of the cove turning from bright blue to a deep, dark red. You're almost grateful, though, because the carnage itself is partially obscured. The end of The Cove is as rousing as anything from Hollywood. Manipulative? Sure. But isn't that fitting? Profit has driven an entire village to massacre dolphins and keep its work hidden. Now comes the exciting documentary, likely to be a crossover international hit. You can't get away with killing Flipper. It's the bad guys in the end who are dead in the water.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed the new documentary, The Cove. We'll meet the filmmaker and the activist he follows after a break. This is Fresh Air. We just heard David Edelstein's review of The Cove, the new documentary about the capture and slaughter of dolphins in a cove in Japan. Here's another scene from the film. This is the diver Edelstein mentioned, Mandy Ray Cruikshank, who plants the hidden underwater cameras to document the dolphin slaughter. She's describing an encounter with the fishermen in the cove.
Our first encounter with the fishermen was we went down there at first break of light, and as soon as we arrived, a number of fishermen showed up. We were down by the beach looking at, you could see the blood coming out of the killing lagoon. You could see a bunch of the babies were cordoned off by themselves away from their parents while their parents were all being slaughtered. And so I wanted to get a better look into the lagoon. And as Joe and I tried to walk down this path, some of the fishermen came and actually butted chest against us. Trying to stop us from getting that vantage point on the killing. And just after that, we walked down to the water's edge, and this one poor dolphin, you could see it trying to get away. And it was swimming straight for us in shore, and it actually made it over a couple of the nets. And every time it came up for a breath, you could see all this blood coming out behind it. And then you could see the last couple of breaths it took, and then it went down and we never saw it again.
My guests are the director of the film, The Cove, Luis Sahoyas, and the main character the documentary follows, Rick O'Barry. Sahoyas worked as a National Geographic photographer for 18 years and has shot covers for Smithsonian, Discover, Time, and Newsweek. In 2005, he co-founded the Oceanic Preservation Society. Rick O'Barry trained the dolphins that played Flipper in the TV series. Now he's an activist opposing the capture and the slaughter of dolphins. I asked Sahoyas what it was like to go to Taiji, the Japanese village, where he and O'Barry documented the slaughter of dolphins.
Going into Taiji, where this all happens, was like walking into a Stephen King novel. You go into town, and on either side of the bridge going into town, they have these dolphin statues. And then you're immediately confronted with this big mural that says, "We love dolphins" in English. And, you know, the whole town was built around, you know, loving dolphins and whales. And then in the middle of this town is this national park that even Japanese people can't go in. You know, big, tall fences, steel spikes on the gates, razor ribbon, barbed wire, a series of tunnels to get through on one side to get there. And, you know, it was just like, it was like a fortress. And Rick said, you know, that's where this all happens, in this national park.
So let's talk about some of what you learned that goes on at the cove. You said that there's a slaughter there and that it's also the place that a lot of representatives from mammal aquariums from around the world go to find dolphins for their dolphin shows. So what happens there? Like, how are the dolphins sorted out for the aquarium industry versus slaughter? Is there some kind of audition? I mean...
Exactly, yeah. And you can see that in the film. You see dolphin trainers, as many as 30 of them, some of them Westerners. You see them in the water up to their waist, selecting the best, just like I did when we started the Flipper series. We captured over 100, and we were looking for 5 that were young females without blemishes, that are photogenic, and that's what they're doing. You see them at the cove. And I get more upset with the dolphin trainers I see there than the fishermen. The fishermen really think that they are fish. And one of the reasons is the word, the character for whale, kujira, in Japanese translates into monster fish. So they're thinking fish, but the dolphin trainers, who are there working side by side with them, look them in the eye every day. They give them names. They spend time with them. They know they're self-aware. And so I get more upset with them than I do the fishermen who are slaughtering them. But clearly the trainers are assisting them. And you can see that. The evidence is irrefutable.
So what happens? The fishermen herd the dolphins into the cove, and then the people from the aquariums come first, choose the dolphins they want, and the rest are slaughtered?
The way it works is 13 boats will go out at sunrise, and they go out to sea several miles, and they find these migratory routes that the dolphins have been using for hundreds, maybe thousands of years, and they get on the outside of them, and the boats spread out a couple hundred meters, and they put a long metal pole into the water that has a flange or a bell-like apparatus on the bottom, and they start banging with a hammer, and it makes us literally creates an underwater acoustical net or wall, if you will, and this frightens the dolphins, and they're able to drive them ashore and into the cove, which they seal with a net. And so it's predictable that when that happens, when they drive them in, which is usually around noon or later, it's predictable they will go home and go to sleep. And they won't come back until the sun comes up. So that's our window of opportunity to bring in CNN, the BBC, or Luis Ojeda and his film crew, or whoever.
Now, you mentioned the way the dolphins are herded into the cove is through this kind of ring of fishermen in boats making noise. Yep. And dolphins have sonar, the equivalent of sonar. I mean, they are very, very sensitive to sound. So
exactly, so that must be their downfall.
So that must be pretty upsetting to them to hear that they're fleeing that sound. Is that what's happening?
They're terrified. They are in sheer terror, and they're running sometimes for 3 or 4 or 5 hours from these boats. And by the time they get to the Killing Cove, they are exhausted. And babies are left behind, mothers, you know, pregnant females abort, the old are left behind. It's amazing what goes on there. It's just so over the top in terms of cruel, more than a slaughterhouse. Some people compare this to a slaughterhouse, but in a slaughterhouse, you don't terrorize the animals for, you know, I've seen them do this for up to a week. So, yeah, that's what happens. They're driven in, and the best are selected by the captivity industry, mainly China. A lot of them going to China right now. The last group went to Mexico, to Cancun, so that tourists can swim with them. The group before that went to Turkey and the Philippines, different parts of the world. They haven't come into America since I think it was 1993, Earth Island Institute wrote a letter to the National Marine Fisheries Service warning them that if they continued to issue permits to allow these dolphins into America, we were going to file a lawsuit. And that's when it stopped.
Luis Ojeda, you, among other things, planted microphones in the cove so you could hear the dolphins' sounds. Would you describe the tape that you got back from the cove?
Horrifying. I mean, we wanted to, you know, we don't know what the dolphins are saying, but you can actually, you know, you could tell they're terrorized. The squeals are just, I don't know, they're deafening. I mean, Rick
yeah, the purpose of banging on these poles is to terrify them. It's very deliberate. It's to terrify them.
And so, Louis, the tape that you have is tape of the dolphins after they're trapped by nets in the cove and they're waiting there to be chosen for aquariums or to be slaughtered? Is that where the tape comes from?
Yeah, the sounds that you're hearing are actually when they're getting killed.
I see. In order to hear what we're talking about, why don't we hear a clip from the film? And this is the part where you're playing the tape of the dolphins squealing as they're being slaughtered? Is that what you're saying? This is as they're being slaughtered?
Exactly.
Okay, here it is. That's the sound of dolphins as they're being slaughtered in a cove in Taiji, Japan. And what goes on in this cove, how dolphins are slaughtered and how dolphins are also sold at very high prices to aquariums around the world is the subject of the new film, The Cove. And my guests are the filmmaker, Luis Ojeda, and Rick O'Barry, who is a former dolphin trainer. He trained the Flipper dolphins for the TV series, and now he is opposing the slaughter of dolphins or the capture of dolphins. Why are the dolphins slaughtered? Is it for dolphin meat? Look, what happens to the slaughtered dolphins?
Well, there are two reasons. One is, yes, for the meat, which we've learned is highly toxic.
Because of mercury levels.
Yeah, mercury. And pest control, using their own words, these few fishermen who are doing this. And by the way, it's not the whole town of Taiji, and it's not the country of Japan. Most people in Japan don't even know this is going on. It's a small group of people. We're talking about 13 boats, two men in each boat. That's 26 men, plus others in the slaughterhouse and in the union and truck drivers. So it's a relatively small group of people. But one day, my wife and I were there 5 or 6 years ago, and the police took us into the city hall, and we had a meeting. And they said, this is the first time we ever sat down and talked to Westerners. This is, incidentally, a very remote part of Japan where you don't see Westerners. But we offered to subsidize this. We said, look, how much would it cost if we subsidized you? In other words, if your boats didn't go out for this year, let's just try it for 1 year. We'll pay you the same amount of money that you would make had you gone out and killed the dolphins. And they translated that around the table, and it came back. It's not about money. It's about pest control. In other words, overfishing is the real problem. They've overfished the coast of Japan to the point where they see dolphins and other whales as competition. Kill the competition. So that's the problem. That's one of the problems, overfishing, and that's a worldwide problem. That's not a Japanese problem.
But again, getting back to what's done with the dead dolphins, you're saying part of the reason that they're slaughtered is that they're seen as competition for the fish that the fishermen want to catch because the dolphins eat the fish. But what else is done with the dead dolphins? How much of it is sold as dolphin meat?
Nobody knows the real numbers because, you know, 23,000, the numbers are down now, incidentally. Last year there were less than 20,000 killed, but they end up in supermarkets, and we've gone to those supermarkets and we've tested the meat, and the mercury level is higher than the fish that impacted more than 200,000 people in Minamata in the 1950s. So it's not fit for human consumption. It's not fit for fertilizer to be put in the ground or pet food. And those are the three things they do with it.
My guests are the director of the new documentary, The Cove, Luis Sahoyas, and the activist he follows, Rick O'Barry. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Luis Sahoyas, the director of the new documentary, The Cove, which documents the capture and slaughter of dolphins in the Japanese village Taiji, and Rick O'Barry, the activist the film follows. O'Barry has been arrested many times for his protests against dolphin slaughter and his attempts to free captured dolphins. Luis Sahoyas, I'm going to put you on the spot. A lot of people will see your movie, be appalled at what's happening to the dolphins, and at the same time think that Rick O'Barry is a real zealot. And I'm going to put you on the spot, Louis, and ask you what your impressions of Rick are now, having worked with him. I mean, he's been so, obsessed with this for decades.
Rick, you know, like, look at him in the eyes. He's a hero to me. I mean, I really, really look up to him a lot. I know what it's like to be working in Taiji, but I'm connected by, by walkie-talkies with headsets to my team, and, I'm really protected. But I've been back in America, and it's 5:30 in the morning back at the Cove, and Rick's there by himself. You know, a dolphin is the only wild animal known to come out and rescue a human being. Rick is the only person I know that'll risk his life to save a dolphin. And it's sort of ironic, too, that the only way that we can, Rick can save a dolphin now is to prove that humans are putting so much garbage into the water right now that they're contaminated, so you can't eat them. There's an amazing irony going on here. But
Rick O'Berry, you've been, you started working with dolphins in the early 60s?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How did you become a dolphin trainer?
Well, my first day on the job.
Did you train dolphins before training Flipper?
No, I was in the Navy before I went to work at the Miami Sea Aquarium. Actually, the first, I had a 14-day leave when I got out of boot camp in the Navy. And it was on Christmas Day, 1955. That was opening day of the Miami Sea Aquarium. And I was there with my family. And I looked inside the tank. There was a big main tank, they call it, 500,000 gallons, full of dolphins and jewfish and turtles and sawfish. And there was a guy walking around with a canvas suit and a helmet on, a Miller Dunn helmet. And I thought, wow, when I get out of the Navy, I'm going to come back and get that guy's job. And I did.
What changed you? What changed you from the dolphin trainer, the highly paid dolphin trainer for Flipper, into someone who is kind of risking your life, doing protests, freeing captive dolphins, sneaking into areas where you're not supposed to be, and so on? Was there like an aha moment where you suddenly changed, or was there a slow evolution?
Well, I was as ignorant as I could be for as long as I could be. And, you put your blinders on. It's what they call it in the industry. And you go to work. And, I was getting paid a lot of money and buying a new Porsche every year. And it's very easy to lull yourself into complacency. So, yeah, I knew they didn't belong in captivity, but I didn't do anything about it. And, one of the reasons I left that industry, and I walked away from it, incidentally. I didn't, I could have stayed with it. But I got tired of being a professional liar, hypocrite. To be successful and to stay there doing that, I thought, I'm going to have to continue lying to the public. I'm going to have to lie to the media, and I'm going to have to lie to myself every day.
In the movie, in the documentary The Cove, you describe that one of the dolphins, Kathy, who you trained for the Flipper series, died in your arms, and that was a real turning point for you. Do you want to tell us what happened?
Well, I knew at that point dolphins didn't belong in captivity, but I didn't do anything about it. And it wasn't until Kathy, the one I thought of as Flipper, at least, died in my arms at the Miami Sea Aquarium, suicide. And I use that word suicide with some reservation, but I don't know another word in the English language which describes what is indeed self-induced asphyxiation. And so your listeners need to understand that dolphins are not automatic air breathers like we are. And every breath is a conscious effort. And they can end their life anytime they want to by not taking the next breath. And I have seen that since Kathy committed suicide many times. I see it in the Cove in Taiji almost every day from September through March. And somebody standing next to me, maybe they don't see it because they can't read the dolphin's body language like I can, but I'm watching them commit suicide. And I've seen it happen many times in strandings, and I think it happens in captivity more than it's recorded.
Before Kathy did what you describe as suicide, did you sense that she was unhappy in captivity?
Yes, extremely depressed.
What were the signs?
The sign is, and this is what I call captive dolphin depression syndrome, they will simply lay on the surface of the water with their head up against the wall and lay there like a log. They don't do that in the wild. And it's so depressing, you can feel it. And that's one of the reasons, you know, at the Miami Sea Aquarium, there's an orca, Lolita, in captivity that does that in between every show. And that's the reason they get everybody out of the theater as soon as the show's over. They don't want people to see that. And I must say also, because you used the word zealot, and the industry does that a lot, but I must tell you, if you were to come with me, and I would like to invite you, to Taiji in September and stand there at that cove and experience the extreme violence and cruelty. You know, when that kind of extreme violence is absolute, one should oppose it absolutely. And that's what I do. If that's a zealot, then I'm guilty.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, yeah.
Luis Ojoyes directed the new documentary, The Cove. Rick O'Barry is the activist the film follows. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shurrock. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures with the new comedy 500 Days of Summer, featuring Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Zooey Deschanel, now playing in select theaters. From the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. And from Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with choreographer Merce Cunningham. He died Sunday at age 90. And we'll listen back to an interview with Cunningham's longtime collaborator and life partner, the late composer John Cage. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.